of the world. That's been some of the news on the Progressive Forum.
All right, Larry Krazan, thank you so much for the news. We're going to get out of here, make room for Jacqueline Batiste coming up next. Thanks for being there.
Thank you. This is the Progressive Forum. See you next week.
See you then.
You are listening to KPFT Houston.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
KPFT Artist Profile.
Hi, I'm Carrie Melanson. KPFT has been completely, totally influential in my musical life, and I think the entire Houston music scene, it's a beacon for music, arts, songwriting, Americana, roots music, things that you can't hear anywhere else. It's amazing. It's the local flavor that when you're driving across the country, you hope to find, you know, while you're on a road trip or something. You're not just hearing the same stuff on the streaming platforms, whatever, and you get to hear what's here. You get to hear what came here before, and it's really great. It's an education that everybody needs to hear these incredible songs. It's just an amazing opportunity for local and regional musicians.
Listen for his music and other independent artists here on KPFT Houston.
We've all felt
KPFT
left out.
KPFT Houston, People of Earth, is next.
Crying looking for you. I'm crying looking for you.
This is KPFT Community Radio, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 FM in Huntsville. Thank you for being with us tonight for People of Earth, Indigenous radio that advocates for Indigenous peoples, communities, self-determination in honor of those who have gone before and the resilience of the Indigenous culture that is today very much alive.
Circling around and around on this wheel of life. breathing in and out, life breathing in and out, love, connecting all that is and embracing here and now, here and now, here and now. If we only seek, we won't find, 'cause seeking makes human hearts blind. If we only seek, we won't find, 'cause seeking makes human hearts blind. Be open and trust, 'cause what may come to you will come right through you, to you, through you, to you, through you, to you, through you, circling around and around and around on this wheel of life. Breathing in and out, life, breathing in and out, love, connecting what I is and embracing here and now. Pure and true gratitude streaming from me to you, whole life, praying for awareness, now is the time to unite, unite. Pure and true gratitude streaming from me to you, all life, praying for awareness, now is the time to unite, unite, connecting to the universal heartbeat, 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 heartbeat.
Hey, you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. I'm Jacqueline Batiste. I'm of the Alabama Coushatta peoples of East Texas. And we're off the FM air just now. We had some issues. We'll get them back up soon enough. So this is actually for our internet at 90.1 FM. I mean, 90.1, kpft.org, and that's where you can hear what's going on here at KPFT. So, in Houston, and again, this is People of Earth. So, wanted to take some phone calls, but we're not going to do that tonight. I'm going to share some of this with you from... Again, Claudio Sant and Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory. So that's some of that coming up shortly. I want to share some information with you, some maybe news and all. One thing about books, you know, there's some new books. This is a new one, and this is called The Problem with Plastics, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. And that's by Judith Enck. That's E-N-C-K, E-N-C-K. And The Problem with Plastic. And it was just released by the New Press and on December 2nd. So it's fresh, hot off the press. And The Problem with Plastic critically examines the paradox of this material, first celebrated for its innovations and now recognized for its devastating environmental and public health impacts. With clarity and urgency, the book reveals how plastic pollution contributes to poisoned oceans, polluted air, a warming planet, and overwhelming waste, disproportionately impacting marginalized communities who bear the brunt of petrochemical pollution. So, revealing the alarming extent of microplastics infiltrating both the natural world and the human body, our bodies. This compelling narrative challenges the illusion that recycling alone will save us. It unpacks the mechanisms of environmental racism and the deceptive greenwashing strategies used by the plastics industry to maintain this status quo. So the problem with plastics, it emphasizes the urgent need for action against plastics' toxic legacy. So again, the problem with plastics, how we can save ourselves and our planet before it's too late, again by Judith Enck, that's E-N-C-K. So there's other books that you might be interested in if you listen to this program. And one is Turtle Island, Foods and Traditions of the Indigenous Peoples of North America. And it's by Chef Sean Sherman. And he's a national bestseller, uncovering the stories behind the foods that have linked the natural environments, traditions, and histories of Indigenous peoples across North America for millennia through more than 100 ancestral and modern recipes from 3-time James Beard Award-winning Oglala Lakota Chef Sean Sherman. And so organized by region, this book delves into the rich culinary landscapes of Turtle Island, as many of us Indigenous people call this continent. We learn to eat with the seasons, consume meat and fish, nose to tail, focus on plant-forward dishes, and discover how better to feed yourself, alongside delicious recipes like smoked bacon, ribeye, wild rice-crusted walleye cakes, charred rainbow trout, and grilled ramps, sweet potato soup with venison, dried venison, and chili oil, and also sunflower seed risotto, and also there's sweet corn pudding. That's just to name a few of the recipes that you can find in this book. Turtle Island features rich narrative histories and spotlights the communities producing and gathering and cooking these foods, and the remarkable stories of ingenuity and adaptation that capture the resilience of Indigenous communities. So there's that. And also, another book you might be interested in is The Service Berry, Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And it's been out for a little while, and it's the New York Times best-selling author of Braiding Sweetgrass, a bold and inspiring vision for how to orient our lives around gratitude and community. And as an Indigenous scientist and author of Braiding Sweetgrass, Robin harvests service berries alongside the birds. She considers the what lies at the heart of the gift economy, and how she asks, can we learn from Indigenous people, Indigenous wisdom, and the plant world to reimagine what we value most? So our economy is rooted in scarcity, in competition, and even hoarding of resources. And we have to surrender the values, our values, to a system that actively harms what we love. So this book is more about interconnectedness and gratitude. And so, again, that's written by Robin Wall Kimmerer, and she's a mother, a scientist, a professor, enrolled member of Citizen Potawatomi Nation. She is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants, and also as well as Gathering Moss, a natural and cultural history of mosses that came out, I believe, in 2022. Anyway, there's that. So, you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. Listening to People of Earth here on KPFT, and to mention that this music you're listening to is Mujeres con Palabra, Love Song, from the Inlac Ek. That's L-A-K-E-C-H, Mujeres con Palabra. And we'll get back to some of that. Also want to mention, though, that, of course, we are being warned, and scientists have been warning, that climate change, fuel, heat records, stronger storms, all but certain over the next 5 years. The scientists are warning. And this information is actually from CBS. And to get ready for several years of even more record-breaking heat that pushes Earth to more deadly, fiery, and uncomfortable extremes. Two of the world's top weather agencies forecasts. So you can go on, and there's so much that you can read about that and learn, you know. Also to mention, at Padang, Indonesia, the toll is deadly. In this deadly, deadly flooding and landslides across parts of Asia, it climbed to past 1,000 this week, and as hardest hit Sri Lanka, and Indonesia deployed military personnel to help survivors. So, again, you're listening to People of Earth. Okay, going to go ahead and start with this information, and it's Claudio Sant, and one of his most recent book, Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory. And you might have been watching the American Revolution series by Burns that came on a couple of weeks ago for the whole week. And this is going to share a lot of information. He is also the author of West of the Revolution, An Uncommon History of 1776, and The Unmaking of an American Family. And then also A New Order of Things, Property, Power, and the Transformation of the Creek Indians. That one came out in 1999. So he has developed several online projects. So there's that. One is called Native Ground. So we hear that. Did want to take phone calls tonight, but we won't be able to do that at this time.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. In the late 1820s and throughout the 1830s and really even through today, the term Indian removal has been used to verbally soften a set of harsh U.S. policies to deport entire populations of Native people in the Deep South, in states like Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama. It was done to take some of the most fertile land, this policy, in the world at the time, and it was also done in order to expand slavery. Today we are going to be in conversation about this history. My guest is Claudio Sant. He is the author of the book Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory. He was a finalist for the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2020 and winner of the Bancroft Prize in 2021. He is also the Richard B. Russell Professor in American History at the University of Georgia. He joins us via Zoom. Claudio Sant, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
It's great to speak with you, Mitch.
You don't use the term Indian removal, really, in your book. Tell me why.
I don't use the term, and it's astonishing that we have inherited that term and continued to use it for almost 200 years now. That was a term coined by the proponents or advocates of the policy in the 1820s to describe something that was really much more horrendous. So I call it an expulsion, which is historically appropriate. That's what opponents called it at the time. I also call it a deportation occasionally. Some observers from abroad referred to it at the time as a deportation. And then I also refer to it at certain times and places as a policy of extermination. And then that, too, is historically accurate. There were high-level officers in the U.S. Army corresponding with each other who explicitly said that the Secretary of War went for a policy of extermination in the case of the Seminoles. But Indian removal, it doesn't capture, as people at the time noted, it doesn't capture the violence that underlay this policy. So I do not use it, as you say.
And it was purposefully used. I mean, that's why I said in my introduction, but I learned that from your book, is that they deliberately used the term Indian removal in order to sort of soften its image.
It was part of a much larger propaganda campaign. We think of propaganda as a 20th and 21st century phenomena, but back in the early 19th century, Andrew Jackson sent out political operatives around the country to promote this policy. He wanted to make this the centerpiece of his administration. And so they wrote opinion pieces and they placed them in newspapers and magazines, and these were printed and reprinted. And they were misleading in all sorts of ways. But the gist, the overall gist of these policies, of this propaganda, was that this was the best thing for the subjects of the policy, that this was the best thing for the victims, that this was a benevolent and philanthropic policy. And so Indian removal, this benign term, was part of that campaign.
You compare what happened in the 1830s with this deportation of Native people from what we consider today the Deep South. You compare it to other great forced mass expulsions in history, even in ancient history, globally. But you also say there's something different that distinguishes what happened in the 1830s from other times.
Yes. So this is probably the most familiar topic in Native American history. And I've been teaching in this field now for almost 30 years. And since it was seemingly so familiar, I it wasn't something that I really explored myself in my own research. I was working in other subjects. And so this is my fourth book, but what got me into the subject is that I inherited this, my grandfather's papers, and he escaped from Hungary in 1938 and then continued corresponding with his family in Hungary through 1943. Hungarian Jews were among the last to be deported in the spring of 1944, and they were sent to Auschwitz. So I inherited the correspondence. It was all in Hungarian. I had it translated, read through it, and then started reading some of the historical secondary literature on deportations in the 20th century and began asking myself, why do we not talk about Indian removal in the same way? Why do we use different language? Why is there a sense of inevitability surrounding this event? Why does the literature talk about it only as a tragedy? It certainly was a tragedy, but there is very little on the massive state bureaucracy and that was built up around it, and on the administration of the event. So I began thinking about it comparatively, but not just comparatively, to draw connections between these later deportations and better known deportations in the 19th century and 20th centuries. And in fact, there are historical connections. There were state administrators in France in the mid 1830s, after the invasion of Algeria, who looked to the United States as a model for what to do with so-called indigenous peoples. And Germans did the same in Southwest Africa in the late 19th century. And then most notoriously, Hitler referred to people in Eastern Europe as native people. He said the Volga River will be our Mississippi. He saw it as a kind of comparative model of expansion, and this time expanding eastward instead of westward, as the United States did. So what all of these modern deportations have in common is the massive state bureaucracy and administration that is built up around them, and the desire to create a kind of uniform citizenry. And so in which people whom state administrators deemed did not belong would be eliminated in one way or another. So I do think it is one of the first state-sponsored mass deportations in the modern era.
You mentioned the French in Algeria roughly around the same time. This is where we get the word indigenous. It's a French word.
Well, what's interesting about this is that they, the French were using the word indigène to apply it to native peoples in the Americas long before France invaded Algeria. It's in the 1830s when they begin to apply it to people who live in Algeria. And the reason they apply it, they're calling them indigenous people. The reason they're doing that is that, again, they're looking at the United States as a model for what to do with colonized peoples, how to treat them, how to dispossess them, in essence.
Looking at what happened here in the United States, again, in the Deep South in the 1830s, before that, ever since Europeans arrived to the continent, they've been taking land from Native Americans, Native people. But there is something significant and a shift in U.S. policy in the 1830s. Can you talk to me about that?
Right. Dispossession begins almost from the very first day when Europeans set foot in the Americas. So it is a long and an ugly story. And when the United States was created, George Washington and Adams and Jefferson continued this policy of taking land from Native peoples. But those dispossessions beginning in 1500 approximately occurred piecemeal and haphazardly. So dispossession might have occurred at a certain time and place because of the introduction of diseases or because Native peoples felt too much pressure because of environmental degradation. So they moved westward. Sometimes there were wars sparked by Europeans. So certainly hundreds of thousands of acres were stolen from Native peoples long before this official policy. I think what's remarkable about this piece of legislation, which is what it is, it's passed by Congress and signed by the president in May of 1830. What's remarkable is that it is the first formal official state policy to, in essence, eliminate every single Native person living within the boundaries of the United States. And that was unprecedented. And it sparked this unprecedented mobilization of the federal government to undertake this mass deportation.
It's really interesting to me when we think about the geographical boundaries of the United States and changing significantly. I think usually we think of the Mexican-American War in 1846, when we basically take half of Mexico and almost grow the United States by almost doubling it, really. And that's what we think about. But in preparing for our conversation, I started thinking also about the 1830s. And the Deep South, places, you know, states today like Mississippi, Georgia, you're in Georgia, Alabama, it wasn't so different. I mean, these were before the 1830s, these were, we think of it today as sort of, you know, bastions of conservative white reactionary politics. But these were indigenous lands before the 1830s.
The transformation that took place is really astonishing in the 1830s. So you're absolutely right. We think about the South today as this bastion of conservatism, although that's changing. But when we think of the history, we also think of sprawling slave plantations in the antebellum era. That's accurate. except that we need to remind ourselves that the very heart of what we think of as the Deep South, the Confederacy, the very heart of it, Alabama and Mississippi, 30 years before the outbreak of the Civil War, was Indian country. And so in 1830, fully half of what became the state of Mississippi was owned, was still the Choctaw and Chickasaw nations. And about a third of Alabama belonged to the Creeks. And the northern fifth of Georgia belonged to the Cherokees. The western edge of North Carolina also belonged to the Cherokees, and the eastern corner of Tennessee. A large chunk of central Florida belonged to the Seminoles. So if you were to look at the South in 1830, it has a huge indigenous presence. Now the number of Native peoples was much smaller than the number of colonists or U.S. citizens. There were about 80,000 indigenous peoples in the 1830s. But again, they had this expansive land base. And so in the space of a decade, these forests, small family farms were raised. The colonists, planters describe cutting down, or rather having enslaved peoples, ordering enslaved peoples to cut down peach trees in central Mississippi that measured an astonishing 18 inches across at the base of the trunk. These were old peach orchards that Creeks and Choctaws and Chickasaws had planted. These were cut down, uprooted, and the land was turned over to cotton cultivation. So tens of thousands of enslaved people were shipped in from the Chesapeake region, and the region was transformed. It's really an astonishing remaking of the demographics as well as the land itself.
Some of the people that we are talking about are the Cherokees, the Creeks, the Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Seminoles. These are called today the five civilized tribes. I want to ask you about that term, five civilized tribes, because it makes me think we're talking about the policy before the 1830s. The United States had a policy, I think it was called the civilization policy, and trying to somehow incorporate the native people at the time into sort of this white European American way of life. And that's another significant change that happens with these expulsion policies.
That's right. For the first two or three decades of the country's history, there is this so-called civilization policy. And it's ethnocentric, no doubt about it. Federal agents were sent off to various Indian nations to teach folks how to be Christians, to teach them to read and write in English, to dress like Westerners. Indigenous women who dedicated themselves to farming were supposed to give it up and practice the so-called domestic arts, to have to tend family gardens and to spin cotton fibers into thread and then work on a loom and turn it into homespun textiles. So they were supposed to be like white women. And the men were supposed to give up seasonal hunting and to become farmers and work behind a plow most of the year. So this was the civilization policy. As I say, it's obviously ethnocentric. It was also some cynical, and in the minds of some folks, extraordinarily cynical, because the ultimate goal was simply to get Native peoples to cede their hunting grounds, with the idea that a family farm would be much smaller, 40 acres, say, and then the United States could have the rest of the land. But it wasn't always cynical. There certainly were philanthropists who had convinced themselves that this was the best thing. And the goal then was that these folks would become U.S. citizens eventually. So that policy is overturned with the Jackson's effort to dispossess and expel Native Americans. He says, well, it's hopeless to turn these savages into civilized folks. Maybe in a century or two we can do it, but in the meantime, we will send them out to this place we'll call Indian Territory, and they can live in this segregated space, and we can have the rest of the land.
Yeah, you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org, People of Earth. It is Indigenous radio. So we're going to get right back to Claudio Sant, and he is, this is with Letters and Politics from our sister station, KPFK Pacifica in LA. So here we go, back to that.
Tell me more about Andrew Jackson. He's elected president in 1828. He lost in 1824, controversially. We've talked about these things when we talk about the Electoral College. We'll put that to the side because our time is limited. But in 1828, was he campaigning for the expulsion or deportation of Native people in the southern eastern portions of the United States? And what was the movement around this for such policies?
So he doesn't have to explicitly campaign for expelling Native peoples because white Southerners especially, they already know him as a war hero. Now, he was a war hero because of his victory over the British in the Battle of New Orleans in 1814. But he's also a war hero because he slaughtered the Creeks in the Creek War of 1813 and 1814, culminating in this battle of Horseshoe Bend, which really was just a massacre in which some 800 Creek women, children, and men were cornered in a bend of the Tallapoosa River and shot down. Some of them tried to escape by swimming across the river, but Jackson had stationed troops on the other bank, and they shot these people as they were swimming. So he was a land speculator. He was a slave owner. He was sympathetic to what he thought of as the plight of white men in the South. So they knew what his feelings were about Native peoples. He was contemptuous of them. He thought that a treaty was a farce, not an agreement that the United States, between two sovereigns, that the United States ought to honor. But he said it was just a piece of paper to keep Native peoples happy in the short term, there was no obligation on the part of the United States to honor these treaties.
Just wanted to quickly interject. He ignored a Supreme Court ruling saying that the United States had to, and it's a controversial set of rulings, I understand that, but part of it was that the United States had to abide by a treaty with the Cherokee Nation. And I think it's apocryphal. I don't know if he actually said this or not, but something to the sense of, he said, Chief Justice John Marshall made his ruling. Let's see him enforce it.
Right. It appears those words may have been apocryphal, but largely irrelevant, because the important point here is that he did disregard what the Supreme Court said. So there were a series of Supreme Court rulings. These were generated by indigenous opposition to dispossession, especially led by the Cherokee principal chief, John Ross, who was very savvy, familiar with the halls of power in Washington, D.C., spent a lot of his time there, knew how things worked, and hired lawyers to take this case to the Supreme Court. And there were two Supreme Court rulings in 1831 and 1832. The second one, Worcester v. Georgia, was in essence a victory for the Cherokee Nation. And it said that the state of Georgia had no right to extend its laws, its sovereignty over the Cherokee Nation. So he and other Cherokees thought of this as a complete victory. The only problem was is that the man at the top of the executive branch, Andrew Jackson, ignored it. And so these state laws that Georgia passed and other southern states did the exact same thing, Alabama and Mississippi, extended these laws over Native peoples and then didn't give them the right to testify in court. And so basically just declared open season for white citizens to squat on indigenous lands, to steal their property. There was nothing that Native peoples could do. So state law became an instrument of oppression, and it became the tool by which these states were able to dispossess Native peoples who did not want to leave.
I want to talk about how the Cherokee Nation tried to resist these policies, and you've already started talking about them by bringing this case to the courts. And it's always complicated when you talk about any particular group of people, because you have different factions who believe that they should do different things. And that was very much true for the Cherokee Nation. But the Cherokee Nation was sort of considered the shining star example of civilization. They basically did everything that the United States asked them to do up to this point before they were deported from their own land. But I specifically wanted to talk about their resistance and the role, because my interest was piqued by their newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix. And you write a lot about this in your book, and it was really interesting. Can you tell me about their newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix, which was published both in English and in their own language, the role of what that paper had during this period of time?
Right. So there are indigenous leaders across the country who are fighting this policy, but probably none as effectively as the Cherokees. And that's for a lot of reasons. But in part, it's because a number of their leaders were fluent in English. In fact, their first language was English. And John Ross, whom I already mentioned, was just extraordinarily wise to the ways of U.S. politics and a gifted writer, and could write circles around Andrew Jackson. So so I mentioned this Jackson's propaganda campaign earlier, and one of the frustrations for Native peoples was some way to counter all of this disinformation that was being spread to U.S. citizens. The seat of power in the United States was between Washington, D.C. and New York City at the time. And most U.S. citizens by the 1830s had never seen a Native person. They were not familiar with them. And so it was fairly easy for cynical politicians to tell them, oh, these Native peoples live in squalor, they're all alcoholics. Their numbers are diminishing rapidly. They will disappear if we don't do something about it. They are all hunters. They don't know how to farm. None of this was true. And so Native peoples would read this in the newspapers, and they were extraordinarily frustrated at their inability to combat this disinformation. So that's where the Cherokee Phoenix comes into play. It is the first indigenous-operated, indigenous-language newspaper in the Americas. It's founded in 1828. There, half of it is in English, half is in the Cherokee syllabary, which is invented a few years earlier by this amazing Cherokee polymath from the Eastern Tennessee, Western Cherokee Nation, named Sequoia. And so they start printing these articles saying, well, you know, over and over again, in fact, it's not the case that we're diminishing. Our numbers are stable or even growing, which, by the way, looking at it from my perspective today, I think was true. The best evidence suggests that Their numbers were growing. So they printed these articles and they were picked up and run by newspapers throughout the North, not in the South, because white Southerners did not want to hear the words of the people they were oppressing. And these were the most most moving and eloquent, expressions of the degree of oppression that was being waged by white Southerners. And so they didn't want, obviously, for these voices to be picked up and disseminated. But in Northern newspapers, these articles are printed and reprinted. And so what it does is to generate a fervent opposition to dispossession among white Northerners. And it generates the first massive petition campaign to Congress against dispossession. These petitions were written by the hundreds and signed by thousands and thousands of white Americans. And they flooded Congress. And in fact, the legislation itself, the so-called Indian Removal Act, passes by a mere 5 votes in May of 1830 out of 199 casts. So it really just barely makes it through this Congress that was overwhelmingly Jacksonian.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Claudio Sant, author of the book Unworthy Republic, The Dispossession of Native Americans and the Road to Indian Territory. This conversation was recorded.
And you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM usually, and 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in beautiful Huntsville. So we're going to get back to this interview with Claudio Sant in just a few seconds here.
It's a fascinating and even disturbing look into how the mind works. Before we return to our conversation with Claudio Sant, we bring you this. slavery. Actually, it's this divine North, obviously simplified. And people who fought slavery and white fought against people like John, Henry Dale, can go down this, Charles Soomsley, Stevens. In the South. And what I got from your book, again, you mentioned a very close vote in the House of Representatives on this bill that passed in 1834 removal, 102-97. What was that debate like in this country?
Observers said it raised the debate in Congress to a fever pitch. Observers said they had never seen that much tension and anger on the floor of Congress up to that point. What's really interesting about this is that there's this structural advantage that the South has. And I keep talking about the South here because I think it really is a Southern piece of legislation. And in fact, Martin Van Buren, who becomes Jackson's vice president, said explicitly that this was a Southern piece of legislation. But there's this structural advantage which was built in to the United States in the U.S. Constitution. It's the notorious three-fifths clause, which gave the South in Congress in 1830 an additional 21 votes, right? Because the three-fifths clause says we're for purposes of representation in Congress, we're going to count all the free people, and then we're going to count everybody else and multiply by three-fifths and add that to state representation. So it's these extra 21 votes that make the difference in this really critical vote, which was a turning point for Indigenous Americans, and I think for the United States, too, more broadly.
Yeah, you're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM. KPFT.org. I'm Jacqueline, winding up the program. Just another minute to go. Okay, Chichalu, until next week, People of Earth signing out.
Houston.
You miss your woman, and I miss my man too.
Hey everybody, this is Glenna Bell, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Hey y'all, I'm Anna Lamare. KPFT has been a supporter of my music since day one, and I'm grateful to be a part of this family. Thank you for helping spread independent local music. Support community radio. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Hey everybody, this is Raul Mala from the Mavericks, and you are listening to KPFT in Houston, Texas. 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.